Is it recording already?
Yes.
So I'll put that here. Okay. But it's an organization that I think formed in about 2005, around the same time that the Department of Health in New York City recommended colonoscopy as the primary mechanism for screening and surveillance for colorectal cancer. And I think that this was one of their outreaches, was just to try to improve understanding, progression, guidelines, etc., in terms of trying to reduce the overall burden of colon cancer. So again, the mission of the New York City Coalition was basically increase awareness and screening for colorectal cancer and adenomatous polyps in New York City men and women in order to reduce the incidence and mortality of this disease. I remember being amused. I live in Bergen County, and when something started coming out about the fact that the Department of Health of New York City was now recommending colonoscopy as the preferred method of screening, I kind of felt, okay, that doesn't apply to me. I'm not, you know, living in New York. But I'll just sort of, I don't really get into it with that, but part of the purpose of that recommendation had more to do with an evaluation of the number of people theoretically who needed to be screened, as well as the number of endoscopy suites, the number of gastroenterologists, and the capacity to perform colonoscopy within New York City. So again, the specific role of this program was, you know, essentially directed at healthcare providers and I think by and large non-gastroenterologists to educate healthcare professionals about colorectal cancer as a public health problem, to touch on some of the means and also the effectiveness of colorectal cancer screening, talk about some of the specific guidelines, and again, the recommendations, particularly for New York City, as outlined by the Department of Health, had more to do with availability and capacity. So bear in mind that, you know, colorectal cancer is a disease of worldwide distribution. It's, and again, these are somewhat older statistics, but going back about 15 years, it called about 900,000 cases in 1996, a little over 8% of all new cancers worldwide. As you can see, you have areas of much higher incidence, especially in North America and among our patients from Western Europe. And the number of, you know, and again, in terms of overall deaths, it's also a significant cause of cancer deaths. In most surveys, about the third or fourth most highest cause of cancer deaths worldwide. Specifically, as it pertains to the United States, we can again see close to 150,000 new cases diagnosed in 2005, with, again, over 57,000 deaths. You can do the math and realize that that's a large burden of disease, a significant cause of cancer deaths. And, you know, bear in mind that this is often a disease that, you know, occurs in young... Sorry about that. It's a disease that can occur, you know, as people get older, the incidence increases, but it's certainly something that we see in people in their 50s and 60s. So in terms of person years of life lost is significant, and the lifetime risk of a person at average risk developing colorectal cancer is estimated to be about 1 in 20, about 5%. And so that's another one of the reasons that it's a disease that is certainly should be at the forefront of our minds and have us thinking about what is it that we can do, not only to treat it once we define it, but also if we believe it may be preventable. And so again, estimated, you know, numbers of new cancers both among genders, and you'll sort of see that among both men and women, it's the third most common cause. And you know, because of the fact, let me just go one more slide, I think. Okay, so it's defined as the fourth most common cause of cancer because both breast and prostate individually have a higher incidence, although if you take the genders together, it's essentially the third highest cause of cancer in each group and the second cause of cancer death. Although the overall risks for men may be slightly more than female, it's a disease that clearly occurs in both men and women. We certainly would estimate that as the population continues to live to longer ages, that if anything, the disease burden will increase. An important note in terms of screening guidelines is that 93% of cases occur in people age 50 or over. And the survival rate is approximately 60% at 5 years. That is something that we also believe we can have some impact on and effect on by earlier diagnosis and even prevention. And for reasons that aren't completely clear, African Americans tend to have a lower 5-year survival rate and a somewhat higher incidence. And that's something that's been addressed in some of the more recent screening guidelines. So again, just trying to, you know, point out the same thing. So incidence, you know, doesn't really, it's a significant majority of the cases that occur before age 50. Starting at around age 50, you'll see a gradual increase in the risk of colon cancer in both men and women, affecting both genders, but slightly higher in men, and the mortality curve sort of mimic the incidence curves. Interestingly, though, the incidence of the 5-year survival, not the incidence. The 5-year survival, as we said, seems to be somewhat higher among whites than it is among African Americans, and that's true whether it's colon cancer or rectal cancer. And as far as as far as we're concerned, they're all both spectrum of the same disease. They're not really separate diseases. But one of the things that was addressed initially in the stat, and I believe that this also goes back to the late 90s and early part of this past decade, was that the incidence rate seemed to be somewhat higher in African Americans, both men and women, compared to other ethnicities of that gender. But also, not only the incidence, but the mortality rate was higher. And I think that this was something that became evident as we really embarked in New York City as a model throughout the country of trying to increase awareness and increase the availability of screening for colon cancer, is that there were certain minority groups that were not getting screened with the same frequency. And so I think that the bias that most of us have is that the incidence the disease may be somewhat more common among African Americans. I think that most people believe that the mortality difference is probably just lag time in terms of diagnosis. And that's been a real focus of some of the efforts of both the American Cancer Society and the New York City Department of Health in terms of trying to increase screening availability and capacity, especially to a minority population, to try to reverse those trends. So we should bear in mind that when we're talking about colon cancer, the majority of people who we encounter are described at average risk. Probably about 3/4 of all colon cancers that we encounter are people who have no specific or defined risk factor. There's a subset that may make up 15-20% of all patients where they have a family history, but not one that would fit a prodrome or a specific mutation. And I'll give you some examples of how strong a family history might be in terms of defining one's risk. And then you should certainly bear in mind that there are a handful and really a minority of cases where people who have very, very well-defined genetic abnormalities, familial adenomatous polyposis, which makes up only about 1% of all colon cancers, but it's certainly a specific genetic defect that we've been able to learn a lot about the overall progression and the genetic mutations that occur within the mucosa that allow for the adenoma carcinoma sequence. And then the hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancers, or the HNPCCs, that's actually a picture of Dr. Lynch for the so-called Lynch syndromes. And these are people who seem to have higher risk of both uterine, breast, and colorectal cancers, again, related to a specific germline mutation. And these are people that, if they can be identified based on a family prodrome, have different recommendations for routine screening and surveillance. So again, FAP, as we said, is a rare autosomal dominant syndrome. It's an inherited defect in the APC gene, which is on chromosome 5, and characteristically, it's identified by multiple colorectal cancers and cancer in almost everybody before the age of 40. So usually these are people who, they may have, ideally in our setting, they may have had a relative who was identified as having colon cancer at a young age. They may or may not have had a defined polyposis syndrome. And if that's the case, we would usually start surveying or screening teenagers and kids in their early 20s looking for the onset of these polyps. And if these people were found, they basically have, this may be over here sort of a flatter, more normal area, but each one of these small areas here is a small polyp in what we see in FAP. So if you define somebody with this syndrome, the recommendation is really a prophylactic colectomy to prevent colorectal cancer, because almost all of these people will develop it at a young age. And as I say, the only reason I'm not really going to go through the genetics, I just wanted to point out this point, that this is an example of where a rare disease, you know, provides insight into the development of other sporadic cancers, because this defect or this mutation, which again is seen in the long arm of chromosome 5 of the so-called FAP gene, in patients with FAP, they have this one mutation, and over time that will lead to the development of cancer. In sporadic colon cancers, this is actually the first genetic defect that occurs in over 80% of sporadic colon cancers. And so as people have looked at other methods, and I'll touch on some things including fecal DNA analysis, looking for some of those changes, the finding of this mutation has certainly enhanced our ability to think of and look for other possibilities. Again, HNPCC, so basically this is defined under something called the Amsterdam criteria. So to make a diagnosis of true Lynch syndrome, what you really need to have is three family members across two generations with, again, and it doesn't only have to be colon, it can also be uterine and breast cancer in terms of trying to define the prodrome, the proband. I will argue as a clinician that when you have someone whose 40-year-old sibling is diagnosed with colon cancer, you normally don't wait until, other people have advanced cancer before you start looking. I think that those are populations that we've defined are probably at higher risk. And I'll show you in a couple of minutes, again, the relative risk of having younger family members with significant polyps or cancer to sort of share why I think it's appropriate when you have young family members, certainly with cancer, but even with advanced polyps, of why those people should also be screened possibly at an earlier age. And certainly if one were to define multiple family members that meet these criteria, then I think you're really talking about a family proband that needs to be identified and screened more often. And one of the frustrating or disturbing things about these syndromes is that they don't necessarily follow the same course and certainly in the same time frame. I'll get back to later about what the current guidelines are for colorectal cancer screening, but most of you are probably aware that it's not something similar to mammography or cervical cancer screening that needs to be done every year or every other year. The recommendations are, up every 10 years, certainly no often than every 5 years for a negative exam, but in people with a predisposition, this is supposed to be an example of normal ileocecal valve, at one point in time, and then a year later where you have this cancerous lesion less than 14 months later, and that certainly wouldn't be the normal time frame of the adenocarcinoma sequence. So I think that again points out that if you define these families and define these groups, that they clearly need to be surveyed and screened somewhat differently. So again, the Amsterdam criteria are three or more relatives, one being a first degree relative of the other two, so you can sort of have a brother or sister, and a cousin or something like that, or a grandparent and two children, two or more generations, and in an ideal world, at least one person should be diagnosed with cancer below the age of 50. As we said, this also follows an autosomal dominant pattern developed, has a high risk of colon cancer at younger ages. And again, so in addition to uterine, so ovarian is actually interesting in that ovarian cancer is usually not one of those GYN malignancies that usually portends a high risk of colon cancer. And I think that at least as often you see uterine as part of this, as well as ovarian as part of the Lynch syndrome. But as I said, this is only a small subset of all colon cancers, only about 1 to 3%. And I think, again, so when you talk about the colon cancer based on age, when you define a young adult or a young person with colon cancer, then it's much more likely that they're going to have FAP or HNPCC. But for most of the people, in terms of cumulative, most of the people with these syndromes will have cancer long before they're 50 or 55. What do they say? What do they do? But certainly once you get beyond the age of 50, and just because there are so many more people who fit into this general population, the majority, as we said, over 90% of colon cancers diagnosed at that point are people with average risk. And so here I'll break down a little bit about the overall risk based on other family members. So once you have this sporadic or quote-unquote not an increased risk group of patients, what we find is that having a family history of colon cancer shifts the incidence curve by about a decade. People who have a family member with colorectal cancer, and in some cases, even in some studies, even just having large polyps, will have those people more likely to develop polyps at a younger age and cancer at a younger age. And in a large group here, again, comparing first-degree relatives And patients and using their spouses as controls, as non-environmental factors, and as people who obviously don't share the same genetic risk. The risk of having colorectal cancer in relatives was almost 2, about 1.78 in people just with a family history. Now, you can then define that based on age. And so if you compare having a family member with colorectal cancer at ages 50 to 59 compared to age greater than 60, that relative risk went up to 2.5. And if you compare a family where somebody had not even, you know, cancer, but even adenomatous polyps at a young age, at less the age of 50, and you compare that to a group where no one has polyps before the age of 60, the relative risk goes up to 4. So that's why I'll sort of say you have one young family member, you know, you have someone's 40-year-old brother had, you know, high-grade polyps or cancer, someone whose parent had resection for colon cancer in their 40s, I think that even without having a Lynch syndrome inheritance, those are people who it's not at all hard to recommend doing colonoscopy. And the normal recommendation of when to start timing that is 10 years earlier than the youngest family member developed cancer. So someone had cancer when they were 45, by the age of 35, you should be thinking about getting a first colonoscopy in some of those patients. And so again, in terms of the lifetime risk of colon cancer, we said about 5% for the population as an average. If you have one first degree relative, that was that relative risk of 1.78, but it's approximately, you know, 1 in 17. If you have a first degree relative and a second degree relative, it goes up. Once you have relatives, you know, under the age of 45, two first degree relatives, you know, then you're really running into not insignificant risks greater than 10%, and even a greater awareness that these are people that you'd like to screen earlier. So again, you know, what is it that we look for? What is it that we see? So again, we do lots and lots of screening colonoscopy. I think that in our endoscopy suite, we do approximately between here and North Central about 2,500 colonoscopies per year. At this point, a little more than half of them are done as first-time screening exams. And the question is, what is it that we're looking for? What is it that we see? And the answer is that if you screen a large population, you'll find that somewhere around a quarter of them, I think that 40% is high, I think up to 40% will have a polypoid lesion, and at least in our experience, approximately 22 to 25% will have an adenoma on first-time screening. However, you know, if you then take a look at the lifetime risk of all comers of developing colon cancer is only 5%, and yet at least 25% of all adults will have adenoma, it's clear that most adenoma do not develop into cancer, and that not every single small polyp really has the risk to develop into cancer. That it's really people who have larger adenoma with advanced histology that are probably at greater risk. That said, I'll quote one of my mentors who said he never met a polyp that he liked, and so therefore he removed them all. You know, it's very difficult for us to truly differentiate adenomatous from non-adenomatous, and although there are things in terms of high resolution and other ways of magnification that are, and things like pit patterns and what's referred to as NBI, which is narrow band imaging, that try to differentiate between adenomatous and non-adenomatous polyps, a lot of the technology is not yet ready for prime time and not widely available. So by and large, when we see polyps, we try to remove them. Okay, so I mean, we'll go back to sort of the initial slide to define colorectal cancer as the most preventable but least prevented cancer. And again, I'm going to present, you know, my biases, you know, in terms of surveillance and screening and guidelines that are out there. And some of you, so if I ask that question, okay, we're talking about colorectal cancer, and, you know, even before I saw it, I mentioned, you know, fecal DNA. We'll obviously talk about fecal occult blood. We can talk a little bit about virtual colonoscopy, certainly colonoscopy. And so before anything else, if I sort of say the best screening test is what? Okay, so you've already gotten the punchline, but the truth is that in most populations, the best screening test is the one that gets done. Okay, and the answer is that there are multiple different ways to screen for colon cancer. I'll sum up at the end in terms of why the current recommendations have evolved into what they are. But you should bear in mind that when you have a patient that you're seeing and you believe, assuming you believe that colonoscopy may be the best screening test available, and your patient says, oh, no, I wouldn't want that, or I don't want that, you can try to have a discussion with them. But if they're really adamant about not wanting colonoscopy, then, you know, fecal occult blood testing is still, you know, is still something that's out there. Other things can be done to screen for colon cancer. Okay. Let me just, okay. So, again, and I think it's worthwhile, and I'll sort of digress for a moment at this point to make sure that we're all on the same page. So, again, when we're talking about screening, we're talking about taking patients who have no symptoms. Okay, let me actually define that. I'm not even going to define it as it pertains to the patient yet. When you talk about a disease that is appropriate for screening or a process that is worthwhile screening, what you really want to do is to have something that's common enough in the population so that if you look for it in large groups of people, you're apt to find it. And we've said that polyps occur in 25 to 40%, cancer occurs in 5%. We would think that that's the case. And what you'd like to have is an opportunity to find a disease at an early stage to then have something to intervene for it. Right? The reason that we don't have routine screening for Huntington's disease, even though there's an accurate genetic test for it, is that one, it's a very uncommon disease and screening whole populations for it isn't all that useful, and B, it leads to progressive neurologic disease without really an opportunity to intervene, so even if you define it, there's not a lot that you can do. The reason that we believe that certain cancers, and especially colorectal cancer, is a great disease for screening is the fact that you can find a pre-malignant early stage that is treatable, reversible, curable, and that it's also common enough that screening a population is likely to benefit. But one should bear in mind that when a 40-year-old comes in complaining of having episodic rectal bleeding and you decide to send them for a colonoscopy, that's not screening, that's case finding, or that's for a diagnostic colonoscopy. You know, when you have somebody who has a prior polyp and you're sending them back for another colonoscopy, that's not screening, that's surveillance. So I think that it's worthwhile just remembering what the terms are. You know, screening is really searching for, in this case, a neoplasia, but for a disease or an entity in an asymptomatic population who has no prior disease and really no symptoms related to it. Surveillance is evaluating patients who are either high risk or have had, prior disease to see if they've had recurrence or a new event. And diagnosis is really when you have a patient who has a symptom and you're evaluating that symptom. And I think some of this has gotten clouded over the last number of years with the current recommendations, because I will admit that it's even hard from the standpoint of our GI fellows that when we see a 45-year-old patient who has a little bit of blood on the toilet bowl, on the toilet paper when they wipe themselves, you know, there's a lot of logic that goes in that, well, we know that the bleeding has to be from an anal rectal source. There's no way that, you know, red blood with the brown stool when you wipe yourself is coming from a cecal lesion. But the feeling is that, well, if you would do a colonoscopy in an asymptomatic patient at the age of 50, then why would you do only a sigmoidoscopy in a symptomatic patient, you know, at the age of 45 or 46. So I will, you know, admit and also share some frustration because I've even have some colleagues that will translate that to a 25-year-old with a little bit of blood when they wipe themselves. And I think that while my age cutoff probably falls, you know, somewhere in between, I think that many of us have struggled in terms of trying to differentiate when is it really just case finding and, you know, how much are we concerned about looking at an asymptomatic area. So again, I'll talk about the right colon in somebody who just has minimal rectal symptoms and when are we really doing it. But I think that, again, it's useful to try to define what the purpose is and what our goal is. So again, are there other methods? Absolutely. There are other methods. You know, unfortunately, what's found in large populations that, you know, if you take a look at three-year data, and this is from the late 70s, when the recommendation for routine colon cancer screening was primarily fecal occult blood testing, that only about a quarter of all patients had it done in the last 3 years, and this was certainly recommended to be done every year or every other year, and a third of them had never had it done, and most of those, when asked why, the basic answer was that it was never recommended, and if it was recommended, only a small percentage declined. Some of you may be aware, if you've offered fecal occult blood testing, patients almost never decline to take the cards, but they don't often, you know, they don't always send them back. So I think that 4% decline is probably misleading, because I think a lot of people say, oh, sure, but then they actually have a hard time getting from step A to step B and mailing the cards back. And this is something that really, I think that I don't really have the slides that show the newer data, but I think that this has been a tremendous advance, especially in the New York City area. And once again, I'll give credit to the Department of Health and the previous Health Commissioner, Tom Frieden, who's now head of the CDC. This was originally a project that was very near and dear to him, as well as people from the American Cancer Society, and hopefully all of you in this room know that we have a program that we've run now for 5 or 6 years through the American Cancer Society that allows us to provide free colonoscopies to uninsured patients if it's being done for first-time screening. Okay, and that program is obviously, it's still around. I think in the years that we've been doing it, we by far are the most active site in terms of doing that. I think last year we screened about 340 uninsured patients with first-time colonoscopies, had several patients with early-stage cancers that would not have been detected without that program. And one of the reasons that there's been an awareness in this funding is that it's been clear for years that there are barriers to people getting colon cancer screening. It's inconvenient, it's uncomfortable. If you're talking about having a colonoscopy, you need to take a PrEP, you need to have an escort, you need to get an IV. And if you take a look across populations at the percentage of people who are screened for cervical or breast cancer versus colon cancer, you can sort of see that for breast and cervical cancer, the numbers routinely have been in the 70-80% range. If you looked at colon cancer, and this is all screening, not just colonoscopy, the rate was somewhere around 50%. When this C5 started about 6 years ago, I believe it was 2004 was the first year, I think that the screening rate across the city was somewhere in the range of 50%. And by last year's meeting, I think that looking across New York City hospitals, the screening rate was up into the mid-60s. And the goal is that by 2013, we will have 80% of patients, you know, getting screening for colon cancer. And that also includes, I mean, some of this is an awareness campaign. Some of these people may have comorbid illnesses that makes screening for diseases unlikely to cause problems for the next 5+ years inappropriate. Some of these are people who may have been offered screening and for various reasons declined. But, you know, if we could, bless you. But trying to get to a point that we're at least identifying that we've offered and or performed screening in that percentage of patients is a goal that I think we're well on our way towards. So I touched on some of this before, but why screen for colon cancer? One is that it has some proven effectiveness that I'll get back to. It's a highly preventable cancer because we know quite a bit about its pre-malignant phase. It has a well-defined pre-malignant phase as this adenoma-carcinoma sequence. Some of the recommendations of why we can screen as infrequently as we do is that we do know that it can take, you know, at least 5 years and often longer for a small adenoma, less than 1 centimeter, you know, to grow into a cancer. And I gave you that example before from FAP and the molecular defect, that we do understand much more about the progression and the genetics and the sequence of mutations that's necessary in order for a sporadic mutation to turn into an adenoma and over time to have other mutations and grow into a cancer. So what are some of the barriers? Well, again, some of it is just physicians don't recommend it. People sort of say, you know, and all of you have had patients, I would assume, who basically say, you know, I feel fine. I don't know that I want to do that. And that's not only for cancer screening, that's for blood pressure medications, you know, and other things that we would think are pretty, you know, straightforward. I think some people, you know, have fear of the results and sort of wondering that if I do something, what am I going to do then? But I think that's really a minority. Certainly, people can have negative attitudes about the tests. These are more difficult than some of the other screenings that we recommend. Even fecal occult blood testing, you know, most people don't like handling stools. So you give them a little stick and you give them a little card, and some people still find that to be somewhat distasteful. And everyone has, you know, some concern, real or imagined, or some neighbor, some distant relative who has some recollection of a sigmoidoscopy or a colonoscopy, and you know, they always seem to remember those at the time that they're, you know, seriously considering it. You know, and in terms of practical issues, and this is certainly a greater barrier for us in a city population are, you know, these issues of poor patient adherence, the fact that you do need to be compliant with the diet, you do need to be compliant with the prep, you do need to have somebody else who can come in with you. We, in previous years, have had a program for both evening and Saturday colonoscopies, which although they help some people who otherwise would have had difficulty scheduling because of their work schedule, was a tremendous advantage for people whose escorts. You know, it's one thing for you to take a day off to have a colonoscopy, it's another to take a day off because your spouse or your parent or somebody else, and you have to be there to pick them up. So, and I will say that again, certainly for the majority of our patients at our hospital and around New York City, the programs of the last few years have made costs a significant lower barrier. So what are the current guidelines, and these have not been changed dramatically in the last number of years, but again, so the for an average risk population, and this is from the American College of Gastroenterology from 2000, so the preferred screening strategy was colonoscopy every 10 years. Bear in mind, 10 years assumes an adequate prep and no lesions. Okay, and so I know that, I try to encourage my colleagues and certainly our fellows that every time we do a colonoscopy, we should be making some comment in the recommendations of when the next one should be. So if it really was clean and there were no lesions, our standard default recommendation is 7 to 10 years earlier if clinically indicated. But if the prep is not great, you know, we may recommend 3 to 5, somewhere in that range. One of the alternative strategies that was recommended back then was sigmoidoscopy every 5 years plus an annual fecal occult blood test. Again, seems somewhat cumbersome, and we can talk about that. And then other screening modalities, double contrast barium enema, which I think, you know, few if any of you have probably ever seen that done in your era as being trainees, and I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that people who choose to use radiographic means, we tend to use virtual colonoscopy more than barium enema, although virtual colonoscopy or CT colography is not available at our hospital. But the other problem is that if you've ever seen how a barium enema is done, you're basically putting in a small catheter, inflating a balloon, and instilling barium. And so just by nature of that, the distal rectum, the rectosigmoid, is very poorly seen on a barium enema. So it's really not appropriate to do a barium enema without also doing a sigmoidoscopy. And so I think that when you combine those procedures and the discomfort and the fact that each needs its own prep and they're rarely done together as part of one procedure, it's really the minority of screening that gets done by BE. I sort of like this slide. Only because for those of you who aren't sold on doing something to recommend screening, you know, I think it sort of brings home the point that at this point, the major cause of medical legal issues for primary care physicians as it relates to colon cancer is delay in diagnosis. You know, sometimes it's attributing clinical symptoms in people who may be somewhat younger or somewhat older to more benign things. Sometimes it's trying to find an excuse. You know, that you may, and I'm not going to go through all the data on how one appropriately does a fecal occult blood test, you know, whether you control for diet, that if you have, you know, a patient, again, trying to avoid red meat, trying to avoid certain other foods that may cause a positive test, the fact that that whether you rehydrate slides or not will increase the likelihood of having a positive test. If patients mail in slides and you hydrate them before you put the developer on, you will get a higher positive rate. You'll also get a higher false positive rate. And so some of the debate is, are you basically just causing, you know, more testing and increasing the overall cost by identifying more positives? But most of the data seems to suggest that if you evaluate patients for positive occult blood, regardless of how that test was done, that you get a somewhat higher incidence of findings. And so regardless of what you do beforehand, control for diet, don't control for diet, rehydrate, don't rehydrate, a positive test should be evaluated. It's really not considered to be appropriate to get a positive test and then go back and find out the patient had a rare hamburger the day before and then say, oh, maybe this wasn't, you know, human blood, and then for, you know, say, let me repeat it again in a different way. And failure to screen is certainly one of the causes of litigation, and so the point being that screening of various modalities has been proven to be effective, and offering screening to patients is considered to be the standard of care at this point. So, you know, what is it that we can do, and how effective is screening? So some of these are actually modeled, some of these are actually seen in studies, but so what is the mortality reduction using different screening methods? And you'll sort of see in the fine print that there are studies that have been done both on annual fecal occult blood testing. There was sort of a couple of case control studies that weren't ideal, but were, you know, certainly done looking at sigmoidoscopy. And then some of the data on colonoscopy is extrapolated from other studies that looked at old data related to the incidence of colon cancers in an unscreened population compared to some of the findings that we have currently. So I will admit that this is not the greatest of all science, but the but clearly the perceived or believed benefit of colonoscopy up to every 10 years in preventing colon cancer certainly seems to be a very effective modality. So, you know, some of the studies on fecal occult blood testing, and they were done, you know, over a period of time and enrolled huge numbers of patients. Okay, some of them screening yearly, some of them every other year, with long follow-ups. But what you found was that if you identify people with fecal occult blood test positive, worked up their positive occult blood, doing colonoscopy, polypectomy if necessary, removing cancer if you found one, that the reduction in colorectal mortality was seen in each of these groups. And I actually don't have a p-value, but you know, when pooled, this data did yield statistical significance. You know, in terms of the sigmoidoscopy data, I will present a bias. I think that if you go back maybe, you know, 8 to 10 years, sigmoidoscopy, with or without BE, with or without fecal occult blood testing, was considered to be an effective modality for screening for colorectal cancer. I think that the large majority of that came from this study, which was written in the New England Journal by Selby et al. From a Kaiser group in California in 1992. What they actually did was they looked at a case control of, they took a population, or they identified subgroups of patients with colon cancer, and I'm trying to remember what their control group was. I think that they had several controls for every case, and they looked at the likelihood that they'd ever had a sigmoidoscopy. And what they found, that even having had only one rigid sigmoidoscopy over a 10-year period reduced your likelihood of having colon cancer by over 30%. What was interesting, and I think that one of the reasons that, if anything, this study has moved us away from doing sigmoidoscopy and more towards doing colonoscopy, is that almost all of the reduction was found among rectosigmoid cancers. They had, the two groups had similar numbers of right-sided and transverse colon cancers. And I think that whereas there used to be older data that suggested that that patients who had right-sided neoplasia were more likely to have other polyps or abnormalities in the rectosigmoid, I think that we've learned through the years that that's probably not true. And nowadays, you'll often hear people using an example that doing a sigmoidoscopy is somewhat analogous to doing mammography on only one breast. Okay, that basically, it seemed from these studies that the prevention and the reduction in colon cancer and colon cancer mortality had to do with the segment that you screened. And if you only screen the distal segment, you're not going to really identify or prevent those people who may tend to have more proximal lesions. So, you know, what is it that we find? If you take people, again, at average risk, perform a colonoscopy, you know, what is it that you find? We sort of said that somewhere between 25 to 40% of patients will have an adenoma of any size. When you talk about patients who have advanced lesions, we said that number would be between 3 and 10%. So again, about 1.6%, or you know, 16 per thousand per se, will have an adenoma with high-grade dysplasia. For those of you keeping score at home, at least from the way that we do our data in New York City, we consider high-grade dysplasia and a polyp as a stage zero cancer. So it's even, you know, aside from intramucosal and other definitions, but that's already defined as having an early-stage cancer. But certainly when you talk about larger adenoma with high-grade dysplasia or cancer, you'll sort of see that approximately 5 to 10% of patients would fall into one of those categories. So in this model that we have here, if you were to take 1,000 average risk patients, we said that, you know, somewhere around here it was 7% on the previous slide, but about 5 to 6% will have an advanced adenoma. Of those, it's estimated that about 20% would develop into cancer over the next number of years, and we said about 1% of patients would have cancer. So if you did screening on a general population of about 1,000 average risk people, you would identify, you know, approximately 10 to 15 in this group that will already have high-grade lesions, and another 5 or 10% that have cancer at the initial time. So the way that large groups and certainly insurers like to look at this, and certainly when people talk about public health and trying to define how useful is it to perform things, they like to look at cost effectiveness or the cost per year of life saved. And when you compare it to things that we do routinely and don't even stop to think about, such as, you know, looking at cholesterol, doing mammography, screening for and treating hypertension, it's clear that the cost per year of life added for screening and treating colon cancer is certainly on par with some of these, and again, another couple of examples. And again, I think that most of us, you can have different ethical conversations about heart transplant and people who are sort of end stage, but you know, no one would ever, I shouldn't say no one, it's rare that anyone would really stop and question how useful is cervical cancer screening, should we really be performing it? And yet, when you take a look at the cost per life saved compared to a colonoscopy every 10 years, it's clear that if you wanted to look at a cost effectiveness model, that there's clearly data for that. So as I said, some of the data that we have in terms of the effectiveness of colonoscopy and what we believe to be true about it come from observational studies. You know, one of the larger studies done in terms of trying to define benefits of colonoscopy, and this did not really have a control population. It really then compared the data to other control groups. But something called the National Polyp Study, the center for this, and the person who led this study was Sidney Winterwer, Memorial Sloan Kettering, back in the, I believe, mostly 80s and early 90s. And basically what they tried to do was to define the optimal surveillance. Again, it was an initial screening, but then they tried to identify the optimal surveillance and follow-up pattern, and then also took a look at what they found. And so, in general, what they did was, and again, I specifically didn't include some of that, but it used to be, and you can, some of you may have relatives or have heard stories or still, you know, have patients tell you, you know, that they had a polyp at some point, and so they still go back every year or every other year, you know, for a colonoscopy. And I think that even as recently as 5 or 6 years ago, that was not at all uncommon. Fortunately, today, it's less common. One of the reasons that data came out, and that's not data I'm showing you this morning, this afternoon, but when the National Polyp Study originally identified their follow-up intervals, they started with one group having follow-up after a polypectomy at years 1, 3, and 6, another group having it only at year 3 and 6. And what they found is that the likelihood of having a significant lesion at that one-year follow-up in that group was extremely small, and that the overall data of people who had it at 1 and 3 as opposed to just 3 were essentially equal. And if anything, there's been some data since then that one can even prolong the screening interval, which is why, and I'll get back to that, but it's why one of the greatest advances that we made in recommending screening and surveillance recommendations over the last 10 years is trying to emphasize the real importance of that first-time screening exam. And, you know, if one's dealing with capacity and weights or whatever, I'll show you that it's far more important to make sure that your patients have had at least one appropriate screening colonoscopy for most patients than to worry about whether they've had their surveillance 3 or 4 or 5 years later if they had one tiny adenoma that was removed. But if one were to take a look at historical groups, and the St. Mark's group was a group that was, again, St. Mark's Hospital in England, and what they did was these were people in a pre-endoscopic era who had polyps that were found on barium enema that were recommended to have surgery to remove them, and they refused. And these patients were found over time, and you know they had a certain incidence of colon cancers over the next 8 to 10 years. You know, the SEER group also, in terms of what was found in populations and the incidence of colon cancer. And so once patients had, in terms of the population and their makeup, once patients had their initial exam with their polyp, the expected number of cancers that would have developed in the National Polyp Study group based on a similar model and a similar patient population prior study was that based on size and location and numbers of polyps, it would have been anticipated that about 48 of those patients would have developed colon cancer over the ensuing 7 to 8 years. And when they actually took a look and studied these patients on follow-up, only 5 of them did. Now, again, this data that allows for that estimate of a 90% reduction in colon cancer by colonoscopy. And I think that even by the time they were doing that study, it was no longer considered to be ethical to do colonoscopies in everybody, do polypectomy in one group, do nothing in the other group, and then follow them to look for colon cancer. So that's why you'll never truly have a comparative study of identical findings of what happens if you do or don't do polypectomy. The best we've been able to do is to identify this is what a group like this would have had based on, you know, epidemiology and observed findings in a pre-polypectomy era, and this is what they actually had when we were able to remove their polyps. And I do believe that while it's not a prospective study in the way that we would normally like, I think that it's data that is certainly impressive and suggestive that colonoscopy does in fact remove precancerous lesions and prevent colon cancer. So again, colonoscopy for average risk, you know, again, it seems to prevent incident cancers by removing polyps. We talked about the fact that finding adenomatous lesions on colonoscopy is far greater, probably because you're just looking at greater surface area. About 40% of people who develop colon cancer proximal to the splenic will develop their cancers proximal to the splenic flexure, which is as far as you can really hope to examine on a sigmoidoscopy, and many of those will not have a distal lesion. And it does seem to be that as people report out locations and incidence of colon cancer over the last 10 to 20 years, that there does seem to be a bit of a shift to the right for reasons that aren't clear. There seem to be a higher number of right-sided colon cancers. And clearly the cons are the fact that it's an expensive routine screening test, and it's not, again, it's not like having a pap smear where you go in and there's no sedation and, you know, it's a non-invasive procedure, even if it is somewhat, you know, uncomfortable, embarrassing, etc. But there clearly are some risks of bleeding, perforation, sedation related to colonoscopy that you don't have with some of these other screening modalities and also with some of these other entities and diseases that we screen for. So is colonoscopy perfect? The answer is absolutely not. I think that some of the data that we've tried looking at, we've had a hard time in our hospital trying to institute that, but I think that if you take a look at the risk of people developing cancer within 3 to 4 years after having had polypectomy, it can be about 1 in 130 patients. I think that, one can ask why that is, and so it says, you know, beyond negligence, but I think there is an inherent miss rate. Some of the things that are in development and have started is there's a, and again, I don't think that this is going to be routine, but there's actually sort of a system where you can introduce a separate scope through a biopsy channel of a traditional colonoscope that you can then sort of like make a U-turn with and look at the back set of folds. But if you can just imagine, or if any of you have ever seen a colonoscopy being done, you know, you have lots of nooks and crevices, and the goal is to try to make sure that you visualize all of those areas. But it's not hard to imagine in a small percentage of people that you can have a lesion that's just placed in a very bad spot, hidden behind a fold that's not well seen. And so I do think that there is somewhat of a miss rate. We talked about the variable growth rates in that example that I showed you of the Lynch syndrome, of a lesion that, or an area that appeared to be clear 1 year, and just seems to be in certain populations that it can, you know, come much more quickly. And then there's this whole entity of what's referred to as flat adenoma. There has been some literature coming mostly out of Japan for a number of years that seemed to indicate that even these small lesions, many of them under a centimeter, a size that we normally wouldn't be overly concerned about, but having high-grade dysplasia or even early cancer, I think that many of us were reassured that some of this was probably a genetic basis, that we don't really see lesions like this in the United States as frequently. And there was an article that was published, I think, about 18 months ago from the University of Washington, where they actually had some Japanese endoscopists who were trained and experienced in chromoendoscopy and other techniques to try to identify some of these lesions, who worked with and trained a group of gastroenterologists at the University of Washington, and their identification of these lesions was significantly higher than any other previously seen American study. So I think it's something that we're aware of, it's something that we look towards, but our basic desire and intent At this point is to continue trying to try to find ways to prepare our patients for colonoscopy that will allow for better adherence and better compliance, because I think in our population we find the quality of prep is probably the biggest limitation that makes us concerned about the possibility of a miss rate.
Can virtual colonoscopy
look better than ultrasound? No, and as a matter of fact, the answer is certainly not in what's described, and one of the biggest limitations of virtual colonoscopy is that it's very, very good at picking up larger lesions, those greater than a centimeter, but finding the smaller lesions and the subtle lesions are actually a weakness of it. And so that's unlikely to improve the rate for those. So again, who is it that we worry about, and we talk about screening versus surveillance. So again, certainly people who have villus change or histologic change, people who have large lesions, when we talked about younger patients or those with strong family histories, those are some patients that we might consider that they need more frequent or earlier surveillance, and that should actually be greater than 3 lesions, not necessarily, or maybe it's multiple adenoma greater than 3 millimeters each. But clearly people who have a personal history of multiple polyps, we should be worried more so about the surveillance. But I think that there are multiple studies, as I mentioned before, that really show that most of the benefit comes from the initial exam. And at this point, it says about 25% of all colonoscopies are for post-polypectomy surveillance. I think that that's probably, true in our endoscopy suite as well. I said it's probably about 55% or so that are done for screening. We certainly have, maybe about 20 to 30% that are done for other symptoms, bleeding, chronic diarrhea, sometimes pain, although that's not a great indication. And then it's probably about 20, maybe 25% that are done as surveillance of people with a personal history of polyps. When I mentioned that's one of the great advances of the last, 15 odd years or so has been decreasing some of the screening intervals. So it used to be, people had a history of a polyp. A lot of gastroenterologists paid for their fancy cars and their kids' college education by bringing people back every year for a surveillance colon after they had one small polyp. But we've clearly learned that people with average risk, a single adenoma less than a centimeter, 5 years is appropriate. People who have a family history of cancer and have a single adenoma maybe should be done a little bit more frequently. And then by the time you start getting to either multiple polyps or other findings, we might recommend that. And this is an area where I seem to clash with some of my colleagues from time to time. I believe that once you've had a documented adenoma, your recommended surveillance should be every 5 years indefinitely. And there is data of late that suggests that doing routine surveillance or screening in people over the age of 75 has limited utility. Okay, so that doesn't mean that when we have a healthy, robust 78-year-old that we'll sort of say, no, go away, we won't do this. But you should bear in mind that as people get older, you're really looking to prevent a problem or a disease that's not going to be a problem for another 5 to 8 to 10 years. So the advantage of doing routine screening and surveillance tests as people reach that age is in question. But I know that some of my colleagues have argued that you have an adenoma, you have a follow-up 5 years later, it's negative, you can wait another 10 years. And I don't really think the guidelines support that. And I think that once you've had a personal history of an adenoma, it really should be every 5 years. So I'll finish up in the next 3 minutes or so. But so I've already touched on this, that you really, it's probably if you're choosing whether you're going to increase your resources for screening or surveillance, you really want to do screening. And I obviously show how respectful I am of the other modalities. You'll see how much time I left to go over other methods. But again, so virtual colonoscopy, it clearly for people, my bias would be that as a first-line screening test for most people, it's not the best one, and the primary reason is that it does involve taking a prep, and except for a handful of centers where they work side-by-side with gastroenterologists and radiologists, so that if they find a lesion, they have a colonoscopy the same day with a prep, in most centers, one's done by radiology, one's done by gastroenterology, there really isn't great interaction, and if you find an abnormality on the virtual colonoscopy, and again, the likelihood of finding a polyp is up to 25 to 40%, it means the patient then needs to come back for another test on another day. So, but certainly people who have part of their colon that's not visualized because it's obstructed, people who had, difficulty with colonoscopy, people who really don't want the sedation or can't arrange an escort, it clearly has a role in certain people, has great sensitivity for larger polyps, not great sensitivity for smaller polyps. Just an example of what it would sort of look like as you reconstruct some of the images. So again, this is supposed to be an example of what a 1 centimeter polyp would look like, and then if you do the call, that's actually, it's hard to believe they're calling that 10 millimeters. That's longer than the cell. But yeah, so there's a lesion as suggested on virtual colonoscopy and an endoscopy. And one more. Okay. So, I mean, again, what are the pros, cons? So, again, for a subset of patients that doesn't want to have other things done, it's certainly reasonable, but you still need a prep. The distension from the air is still there, similar as it is to BE and to some people with colonoscopy, so it's not ideal. You can't biopsy or do a polypectomy. You know, I think 50-6% is high, depending on the center that does it and how much experience they have, but probably at least 25-40% will need a colonoscopy, and it probably doesn't do a great job with smaller lesions. This is something that, again, there was a lead article in one of the GI journals last year talking about the improvement in fecal DNA testing. The idea of it is actually, you know, quite great. You have a patient, you know, sort of a comical slide, but, you know, so tail to male, but you basically have a patient, male in a stool sample, and what you're looking in for are patterns of genetic defects that are more common in adenomata or carcinoma. And I'll sort of say that the problem with it, or, you know, so, and the tests have recently been advanced, and there's a new assay that became available recently that really does show 90-odd percent sensitivity and specificity for cancers in advanced adenomata. The problem is that we're really looking to diagnose people, you know, before they already have an advanced adenoma and certainly a cancer. If we're trying to find earlier stage lesions with earlier mutations on that sequence, there it doesn't do as great a job with sensitivity. So it may be, and again, it's far more expensive than, let's say, fecal occult blood testing. It's far less sensitive than either colonoscopy or virtual colonoscopy. So in some patients who are only willing to do fecal DNA, and at a time if insurers might pay for fecal DNA, this may be more sensitive and specific than just routine occult blood testing. But certainly, I don't know that we would recommend it for everybody, and that's sort of a little joke on that. So let me just see what I have left here. Okay, I literally will be done in a minute. So I'll touch on the New York City, you know, issue again. They really did a large survey of endoscopy suites and hospitals within the New York City area, tried to define how many cases they were doing, if they were working at full capacity based on their staffing, but just working, let's say, you know, into the afternoons and occasionally on a weekend, how many cases could they do in a month. They then tried to define how many New Yorkers there were aged 50 to 75, how many people would need a colonoscopy a year in order to do one colonoscopy every 10 years. And they decided that as opposed to some areas in, let's say, rural Oklahoma, that you need to drive 100 miles to the nearest gastroenterologist, that there were actually were enough specialists and enough centers within New York City to accommodate the needs of doing colonoscopy for people in New York City. And so I think they really felt not so much that colonoscopy was so much better than any other modality, but that part of the problem that you have in terms of compliance and adherence is that when there are too many recommendations and too many suggestions, people walk away confused and they don't really know what to do. So the bottom line, you know, recommendation was do something, but we're going to recommend colonoscopy as the preferred method. You know, some of the things that we've been very active here at Jacoby and that have worked throughout the city, this concept of patient navigators, we currently have two. For those of you who actually call and need to schedule procedures, you may, you know, either reach Peter Rosemilly, who are our two schedulers and navigators, and their responsibility really, other than managing the schedule, is to try to make sure that the patients know when they're supposed to be or have an escort, understand their preps, understand all of these other issues, so that hopefully we can do, you know, a much better job in terms of decreasing no-shows and getting people to keep their scheduled appointment. Certainly in other hospitals around the city, it showed that it decreased no-show rates from as high as 30-35% to less than 10%. And you all, hopefully all know about direct referral, and I'll pat ourselves on the back, but not me personally, that we were the first center in New York City offering direct referral for colonoscopy. So again, just some of the things that I mentioned, the sufficient capacity, but one of the reasons that at least in New York City, colonoscopy was, you know, was indicated as the preferred method is that it can both screen, diagnose, and treat at the same time. And most importantly, in terms of that recommendation, that there was sufficient capacity And it seemed that if there was a preferred recommendation, that it might ease some of that. Again, the media certainly, and as I said, this is Colon Cancer Awareness Month. For those of you, you know, who are aware that Katie Carvey's husband died of colon cancer, she helped establish the Moynihan Center down in New York Hospital. She had her first colonoscopy on national TV on the Today Show going back a number of years ago. I mentioned Sid Winawer before from Memorial Sloan Kettering. Actually, a Jewish man bending down at the Pope there, but you know, but certainly, you know, all of those things have certainly helped increase awareness and really have increased screening rates throughout the city. So, you know, bear in mind that it's still, and I said, at least around New York City, this data has improved. But, you know, certainly a decade ago, it was less than half of all eligible patients. Now it's more, and we'd like to continue improving. And it doesn't really matter as much, you know, which test you do, but do something. Okay? And I ran over on the phone.